It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Curious Wisconsin and a look at the life, art, and mythology of salvage expert turned sculptor, Dr. Evermore.
First, we're talking about the news that broke last night that Journal Communications Incorporated of Milwaukee and EW Scripps Company of Cincinnati will merge their media operations.
The companies will merge their broadcast operations, which includes WTMJ's radio and television. We'll headquarter those in Cincinnati. They'll also combine their print operations into one company to be called Journal Media Group. That new publishing company will have the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel as its flagship paper, and it'll be centered in Milwaukee.
Mike Wagner is with us now to talk about this merger and what it could mean for the Milwaukee media market. He's an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this merger just became public last night. Was this a surprise to media watchers in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it was a surprise, at least in terms of the timing of the announcement. There have been whispers in kind of the media watching community for a little while that something might be afoot. And the question was, how could these companies merge and plausibly continue to grow under different kinds of cross-ownership rules and other FCC regulations? But the way that they've done it, it makes it seem as though the script side can grow with the television stations, and the new journal media group can grow with newspapers, which gives them the freedom to greatly expand their reach, both with respect to this deal, but also in the future. They're going to be able to acquire more in terms of television and newspapers, should they want to, as they move forward, assuming that this deal ends up getting ratified sometime next year.
Critics of this kind of consolidation have for a long time been worried about the effect on consumers of having a shrinking marketplace of viewpoints. Now, this is both a split and a consolidation in a way, depending on what area you're looking at, the
right,
broadcast or the print. But how do you see this affecting consumers?
Usually, consolidation results in less issue coverage for consumers and more strident tone in the coverage. And so news coverage from corporations, especially large ones, tends to be a little more in your face in terms of the tone of the coverage. And we also learn less about political issues on average than we tend to learn from privately held or local companies when they own them. So, you know, it's, of course, difficult to know what exactly will happen with these particular companies, but usually when things like this happen, it results in less information for consumers, at least with respect to learning about the kinds of political issues that those who kind of care about the underpinnings of democracy worry about getting covered a lot by the news media.
So this new newspaper group is that's going to include the Journal Sentinel is going to be called Journal Media Group. Can we
right,
talk about who's under that tent now?
A lot of newspapers. The Journal Sentinel is really the largest, and as you pointed out in the introduction, the flagship newspaper. But there are other newspapers all around the country, Wichita, and a lot of other smaller areas as well. And so they'll likely clear somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 billion. All those papers together, at least by some estimates I've looked at, whereas the television side is looking in terms of around $800 billion in terms of revenue. And the benefit on the TV side is that a lot of those are located in swing states. And so that means lots of advertising dollars in presidential election years and, you know, their fair share of advertising dollars in the midterm election years as well. And so the script side will really be making some money in terms of the advertising they're going to be able to the advertising they're going to be able to charge for based on what they've acquired. And the newspapers aren't in as large of cities, but do cover, you know, a pretty vast expanse of the country. And so, you know, one in five television viewers around the country will probably be watching a script station.
Now, it's interesting that the journal side of things is going to be headquartered in Milwaukee, which is
right,
where the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is, of course, right now. Is it good news for Milwaukee that is the decision that has been made rather than vice versa?
I imagine it is. That means there'll probably be a few more jobs in Milwaukee, and it probably makes it more likely that some of the cost savings that always occur when groups use words like synergy, as both of these groups have been using after the announcement of this decision has been made. So, you know, I would expect that folks in Milwaukee, in terms of their employment and the kinds of resources and opportunities available to them, would be better off than some other places where each of these companies might have some holdings. So Cincinnati, where Scripps will be, and Milwaukee, where Journal will be, are the advantageous places to work for either of these companies.
So WTMJ will now be under the flagship of Scripps, which is in Cincinnati. In terms of content, let's look at that for a moment. Do you expect that to change now that the owners will be different?
You know, there is a place where we've seen counterintuitive findings. And so a lot of folks who study media consolidation and cross-ownership and things like that, you know, tell really negative stories about how these kinds of things really are experimenting with the underpinnings of democracy. But in terms of how these have worked in practice on the television side, has generally shown that when larger companies acquire, you know, fairly good-sized stations in fairly good-sized markets, they're acquiring the stations that do a better job of covering the news, and they tend to be stations that are more likely to air debates between candidates in election season, for example. And so there is some evidence that on the TV side, those kinds of acquisitions can help a little bit. But on the newspaper side, it tends to be the result is less informative.
Now, WTMJ is generally seen as being more conservative. Do you expect that tone to change at all now that it's part of Scripps?
There is some evidence that, just in terms of kind of media research more generally, that changes in ownership often result in the places that get acquired adopting political tones that are more like those who govern them. And so, you know, to the extent that Scripps is conservative or liberal in the kinds of political donations they make or the kinds of programs and the kind of news investigations they do on the stations they had owned in the past, we might be able to make some more informed predictions about what changes, if any, might happen at the station. But usually on the television side, if the station's doing well, the company is less likely to monkey with who the anchors are, who the reporters are, than they are on the newspaper side, where cost cutting tends to cut more folks out of the newsroom, which makes political coverage a little more difficult to do.
Now, in our last 30 seconds here, so far those announcing the merger have been pretty rosy about the prospects, but do you have a sense of how this is going down in Milwaukee so far?
I don't have a great sense of how it's going down in Milwaukee. Investors, I think, across the board are pretty pleased, and I think people who are worried about the information provision so that they can make good decisions as citizens of Milwaukee and the surrounding area are nervous, and some others are probably hopeful. So we'll see, you know, the future will tell us whether this was a good decision for the citizens.
All right, Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Mike Wagner, assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
In this week's edition of Curious Wisconsin, we check out one of the state's most distinctive works of art and most distinctive artists.
The artist is Tom Every, better known as Dr. Evermore, and the artwork is the Forevertron, a massive sprawling structure of salvaged metal.
Tom Kupsch has been following Dr. Evermore's work for years. He's the author of A Mythic Obsession, The World of Dr. Evermore. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So can you give us a brief timeline? How did Tom Every, a salvager from Brooklyn, Wisconsin, come to be the visionary artist known as Dr. Evermore?
It's a long and winding road, starting in Madison, where he was born in 1938. His folks and the whole family moved to Brooklyn, Wisconsin, shortly after he was born. Tom had a reputation, even as a child, for collecting odd bits of junk, things people didn't need. It got so bad that his mother actually asked him to find a place in town to put the stuff because it filled the entire yard. He did find a place, and by the time he was 14, he had collected enough scrap metal to fill a railroad car. That was the beginning of his career as a salvage person. Later on, as an adult, he founded a company that was responsible for the demolition of a tremendous number of buildings in the upper Midwest. You have to understand at this time, there was a transition to modern architecture and modern machinery. And many of the buildings that Tom was salvaging were built in the 1800s or early 1900s, and the machinery in the buildings had become outdated. So Tom was a salvager for many years in Wisconsin, salvaging breweries, he salvaged railroad cars, power plants, industrial sites. Eventually, he came up with the idea that some of the objects that he was finding were too precious to turn into salvage. He came up with the idea that they were animated with the spirit of the person who had used them or had made them. So he set these aside and collected tons and tons over the years. Later on in the 70s, he met up with Alex Jordan, the founder and creator of House on the Rock. Mm-hmm. Their relationship lasted about 10 years. It started off with Tom selling him 2,000 whiskey barrels that he had salvaged from a distillery in Kentucky. And they moved on from there. They became quite good friends, traveling the country to attractions and to collect the odd object here and there. Eventually, Tom began to help Alex fill a tremendous room that Alex had built out at House on the Rock. It's called the Organ Room. It's half a football field in dimension, 5.5 stories high. He started off by salvaging the steam water pumping works from Madison, which he brought out to House on the Rock and installed. That was the beginning of a mechanical fantasy that mm-hmm. they both worked on. He followed that by installing a tremendous number of salvage items from his work throughout Wisconsin and the upper Midwest. Brew kettles from breweries who were updating or going out of business, from Gischholt Machine here in Madison, a tremendous number of motors and equipment. So they moved on through this process, through this creative process. Now, these two egos, these two tremendously creative people, worked in parallel for a while, but it was doomed. They were on a collision course, and they did collide, and it wasn't good for Tom. He went through, after he was put out of House on the Rock, he went through a period that he calls depression. Mm-hmm. And it probably was depression. It was certainly sadness. He felt that his world had ended. So many things in his personal life and his professional life had come to an end. And then one day while he was driving his truck, he came up with a family myth in order to escape from these troubles. And the myth involved an ancestor, a fictive ancestor, who lived in the Midlands of England. Now, the Avery family really did come from the Midlands of England, so that part is true. Mm-hmm. He called this ancestor Dr. Evermore. Dr. Evermore was born to a family that was with the Presbyterian Church. His father was a Presbyterian minister, according to this myth. Mm-hmm. One day they were walking through the fields in the evening, and a tremendous storm arose, lightning, thunder. They had to take refuge in a barn, and it lasted for quite some time. We're still in the myth here. Uh-huh. And after it was over, the young Tom, who would become Dr. Evermore, asked his father, where does this lightning come from? And his father, of course, answered in a strict Presbyterian voice, well, it comes from Almighty God, young man. And Tom thought about this for a while and decided, well, if the lightning comes from God, if I can create a lightning force beam and get myself inside of it, I can rise to the celestial spheres. So in the myth, he begins to build the Forevertron.
The Forevertron. Now tell us, for people who haven't seen Dr. Evermore's work, can you describe the Forevertron for us?
Wow. The Forevertron is a machine that's 5.5 stories high. It's surmounted by a glass ball inside of a copper egg and surrounded by electric devices and charging machines that will create an electric force beam, electromagnetic force beam, that will cause the egg to blast off into the celestial spheres. Now, this is 5.5 stories high, mm-hmm. 160 feet long. There are a myriad of parts, and it took years to build. The reason the book is called A Mythic Obsession is because Tom took this myth and he escaped from reality by building the Forevertron. After he came up with this myth and decided to build the Forevertron, he dedicated every moment of his life and all of his energy right to this moment mm-hmm. to building the Forevertron and promoting it.
And around the Forevertron on the grounds there, there are also hundreds, maybe, of his own creations, birds, elaborate birds, and really legions of different Dr. Evermore creations. Can you talk about some of those?
There are thousands of creations.
Thousands, there. Okay.
One of them is the bird band, in which he salvaged musical instruments that were going to be thrown away and made a bird out of each instrument, some of them standing as high as 17 feet high, that personifies or gets the spirit of the instrument. And they're arranged in a band underneath the Forevertron. And in the myth, he made them the music that would be playing when he blasts off in the Forevertron. There are other objects of art that he has created. He has principally concentrated on birds because they're a non-threatening kind of thing. But there are many, many other creations there. It's difficult to describe mm-hmm. this. Yeah. I mean, I can't.
I've seen it, and I don't know that I could either, yeah. But it's all salvaged, mostly metal, it seems like, but other materials as well. It's a precursor to what people are calling upcycling these days. He was ahead of his time in using these materials he'd found.
It's all metal. Tom works only in metal.
Only metal, I'm sorry. Okay.
Only metal. He works in semi-precious metals like brass and copper, but mostly iron. And it's all salvaged material. All of it would have gone to recycling mm-hmm. If he had not reused it here. And many, many fascinating parts would have been lost through the years.
So with someone who's created such big things and with this mythology surrounding it, and talking to Dr. Evermore, what is his personality like?
Tom's conversation flows smoothly between myth and reality and fiction and fact and the present and the future and intergalactic talk. It's difficult when you first meet him to get the feel of what's going on. But over the course of a number of years of interviews that I did with him, we developed a rapport so that I could understand the shorthand that he was using.
And what has been the international reception for the Forevertron and his other works? He's gotten international attention, right?
Yes, he has. He's well known as an alternative artist, a visionary artist. All around the world, people do come to visit the Forevertron from everywhere. And he's been, of course, published in many periodicals and books throughout the world out of great respect for his work.
There have been talks over the years of his works being moved or donated to various places. Can you talk about that, where they might end up?
There's always been a lot of talk about that because the Forevertron and the work do not sit on property that Tom owns. Mm-hmm. They're next to Delaney's Salvage up across from the former Badger Ordnance plant. Mm-hmm. The disposition of the work finally will be in the hands of the family, of Tom and the family. That's always how it has been, and that's the way that will turn out. Whether it will be moved, we don't know right now. Time will tell.
It would take a lot to move, especially the Forevertron itself.
It would take a lot to move, but he has his son Thayer is an expert mover, following in his dad's footsteps, a very good welder, and would be able to do this task.
This is a unique Wisconsin site to go and visit the Forevertron and things like that. Do people here in Wisconsin realize what a treasure we have?
I think yes and no. I think local people, regional people do. Other people don't know where it is or what it is. And it truly is a treasure. There's nothing like this in the world.
Do you think that he hopes to inspire others to pursue their own unique vision? Probably not exactly his vision, the myth and the metal coming together like that. What do you think he wants other people to take from what he's doing?
Tom very much appreciates people coming out and telling him that they're inspired by the work. Oftentimes, younger artists will come out or people who are stuck. They have some sort of block in their work and tell him how inspired they are by his achievement. He finds this a great source of pride.
And for people who haven't been to visit, can you give us some encouragement to get out there and see the Forevertron?
Yes, you need to see this. The words fail anyone in describing it. There is no one who goes to the Forevertron and wanders around there who doesn't scratch their head and marvel at this wonderful work of art.
All right, Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. That was Tom Cupps. He's author of A Mythic Obsession, The World of Dr. Evermore. If you want to start an argument, try asking your friends what they'd pick for the top 50 movies of all time. It's not so easy to do, and films are a little different for everybody who watches them.
Well, our next guest vote probably has some extra clout. He's one of the country's premier film critics. He's just compiled his picks for the 54 must-see films of a lifetime in the book Not to Be Missed. Kenneth Turan is the film critic for the Los Angeles Times and NPR's Morning Edition. Kenneth, it's great to have you here on Central Time.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So how does anyone, let alone a film critic, go about picking their top 54 movies of a lifetime?
Well, these are my favorite films. You know, they're not necessarily the best films ever made. So it was just a question of kind of which ones spoke to me, which ones did I want to see again, which ones did I want to write about, which ones meant the most to me.
Well, so to figure out what films would go on your favorites list, you had to figure out what was important to you as a viewer, what made a film transcendent in a way. How did you end up answering that question?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that because that's exactly what happened. I mean, the process of putting this book together was kind of a process of almost, you know, self-exploration, really letting me see what was important to me. Romances are important to me. I love films that are romantic, and there are a lot of them in the book. I like French films. I like classical films, you know, films that have really interesting storylines and really good acting. I mean, the stuff that we think of as the golden age of Hollywood, I really like those kind of films a lot.
And as a critic, you're serving the potential audience. You're trying to help them figure out what a film is like, maybe if they want to see it. But on the other hand, isn't film always personal? Everybody sees something different, even if they see the same movie. How did you walk that line?
Well, I mean, you just have to. I mean, what I tell people about critics in general is that what you want to do is you want to find, as a reader or a listener, you want to find a critic who has as close to your sensibility as you can find, because everyone sees things differently. You want to find a critic who mostly sees film and sees the world the way you do. So that takes some work, that takes some trial and error. But if you do find one, then it can save you a lot of heartache and lost dollars seeing movies you don't like.
Do you have someone like that, or are you your own film critic?
I have to be my own. You know, I see them ahead of time. It's my job, so I don't have to worry about, you know, why did I spend my money on that film? It's what I do for a living.
Well, you weren't always like that, though. You became Kenneth Turan, the film critic, and you grew up, it sounds like, watching a lot of movies by yourself. How did that affect how you think about them?
Well, I'm used to keeping, I think it was good for me in some senses as a critic, because I got used to, really, because criticism is so personal, the real danger you face is kind of tailoring your opinions to what you can feel the world thinks. You know, like not wanting to like something that you know no one else is going to like, or vice versa. And I think seeing so much stuff by myself as a kid, watching it on TV, really made a difference. It helped me kind of believe in my own point of view. It's not that I'm always right. It's not a question of right and wrong. I have to be true to myself. If I'm not true to myself, it just doesn't work.
Do you have people who say, I always listen to you, Kenneth, but, you know, that other guy or you know, Margola, I don't listen to her?
Yeah, I mean, it's very heartening when people say, you know, I trust you. When you tell me to go to a film, I'm going to go. And I take that responsibility hugely seriously. You know, I really worry about, you know, not saying exactly what I feel, you know, again, for all kinds of extraneous reasons. And I don't want to let those people down.
Well, I want to dig into your list. You go all the way back to the silent film era up to the present day. But we're going to fast forward a bit up to the 1940s because silent film on radio is a little dull. Here's one that a lot of people love. This is, of course, Casablanca. Well, we've got the music there. There's some talking as well in the film.
There's a lot of talking.
There's a lot of talking. Play it again, Sam. I can also almost do the clip here with you, probably, I bet. This is one of the most loved films of all time. But what do you in particular love about Casablanca?
Well, you know, I almost didn't include Casablanca because I felt that, well, everyone loves it. And what more can I say about it? but I kind of saw it again and I fell in love with it again. I mean, it's a classic piece of work. You know, they didn't think they were making Casablanca. It was just kind of another wartime film for Warner Brothers. But it's got a great story. It's got great characters. It's got a really involving plot. It's wonderfully acted. I mean, it's just, it pulls you along and it surprises you. And it's just, it's a rich story. And it's just, you know, it's got these great, great lines that we all remember and that have become, you know, bywords in our culture, like play it again, Sam, or round up the usual suspects. You know, all this stuff comes from Casablanca.
How many times do you think you've seen it over the years?
You know, I don't see them as often as I'd like to because of the demands of my job. Probably half a dozen times, you know, which doesn't say, you know, there are people who see films a lot. And, you know, that's not a huge number, but that's about it for me.
What else is on your list from the 40s?
Oh, gosh, I don't have the book in front of me. I know one that I know is really there, that because that's one of my, you know, their favorites and their favorites of favorites, you know. And one that I know is there is To Be or Not to Be from the 40s. This is just a remarkable film. It's directed by Ernst Lubitsch. It was made in 1942. It was made in some of the darkest times of the Second World War, and it was a comedy about the Nazis. And believe me, no one was supposed to be laughing about the Nazis in 1942. Yet Lubitsch, who was a European refugee himself, he just found a way to deal with this that I think is just fascinating. And it's a great performance by Jack Benny, who we don't think of as a great film actor. And Carol Lombard, that was her final film. In fact, she died before the film came out. And one of the things I found while I was researching it was that the studio had these elaborate plans to how to do it. There had never been a major film that had come out after the star had died. And they had all kinds of advice to theater owners as to how to deal with this, with talking to their patrons and advertising it. It was fascinating.
Hmm. Well, here's a clip from another one that made your list. This one's a talkie. This one is a clip from Sunset Boulevard.
Wait a minute. Haven't I seen you before? I know your face.
Get out, or shall I call my servant?
You're Norma Desmond. Used to be in silent pictures. Used to be big.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
I knew there was something wrong.
They're dead. They're finished. There was a time in this business when they had the eyes of the whole wide world. But that wasn't good enough for them. Oh, no. They had to have the ears of the world, too. So they opened their big mouths, and out came talk. Talk, talk.
That's where the popcorn business comes in. You buy yourself a bag and plug up your ears.
Get out!
She speaks pretty well for a former silent movie star, doesn't she?
Oh, Gloria Swanson was great. And I think, you know, it's a wonderful line she walks with this performance as Norma Desmond, the, you know, the former silent queen. You know, she's clearly like a little bit of a deranged person and doesn't always act well, but we feel just a surprising amount of empathy for her. Her story is really tragic, and she manages to have it both ways. We see how out of control she is, but also how, you know, sad her story is. You know, just listening to that clip, you know, I mean, again, these are films that are favorites of mine and that have lasted, not because, you know, it's received wisdom. You can hear how alive that is, you know, and how exciting that scene is. This is stuff that still works today. It's not like you have to make any allowances for it because it's 50 years old. It's still alive today.
It's a genre that you talk about where it's sort of Hollywood commenting on Hollywood. It's a studio film. Do you feel like that genre is one that is generally an enjoyable one for viewers?
It is for me. You know, I have to say that. I really like films on films, and I think a lot of people do. I think they're kind of a secret favorite for a lot of people, movies commenting on the movie business. There's an early, you know, this one, obviously, Sunset Boulevard is probably the most famous one. Singing in the Rain, which is also in my book, is a musical, but it's also a Hollywood talking about Hollywood. And there's one that's quite early, an early sound film called Bombshell. That's one of my favorites. It stars Jean Harlow, and she plays a character based loosely on herself. And it's filled with all kinds of inside Hollywood references. The Variety review at the time said, you know, people aren't going to get this film outside of Hollywood. It's so inside. But I think we really do get it, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, I want to move up to the 80s. Now, this is the era of John Hughes and Steven Spielberg. How did you get to the movies that you did pick? They're kind of dark horses that a lot of people haven't heard of. And I'll tell you what the three of them are. The Day After Trinity in 1981, First Contact in 1982, and Distant Voices, Still Lives.
Yeah, I mean, it's because, you know, as soon as you say the titles of these films, my immediate reaction is, I want to see that again. you know, and that's what I was looking for in films, films that really involved me so much that I just can't see them enough. The first two of them are documentaries on really riveting subjects. The first one, First Contact, is a documentary on something that happened in the 1930s where miners went into the interior of New Guinea and they found native tribesmen there who did not know that white people existed. And they photographed what happened, you know, what these, the looks on the tribesmen's faces when they see white people for the first time is just astonishing. Day After Trinity is about the men who made the atomic bomb and the kind of what they went through, first being very excited in the discovery, and then once the bomb went off, being horrified because they hadn't known what they really had done. And the last one, Distant Voices, Still Lives, is a British film. It's not that well known, but it's a memory piece. The director's kind of what he's gone through, what his family went through during the World War II era. And there's a lot of music, kind of marrying of music and image. And, you know, that really is kind of amazing.
We're talking right now with Kenneth Turan, film critic for the Los Angeles Times and NPR's Morning Edition, talking about his new book. It's called Not to Be Missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film.
And we want to hear from you. What is your vote for the best film of your lifetime? What's the one you keep wanting to go back to? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking right now with Kenneth Turan, film critic for the Los Angeles Times and NPR's Morning Edition. We're talking about his new book. It's called Not to Be Missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film.
And the door is open for you. What would you put on your own personal list for a top must-see movie of a lifetime? What do you want to watch again? I'm overdue to watch The Maltese Falcon again myself. Call in with yours at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, I want to touch on one of my favorite filmmaking teams ever, Merchant Ivory. They're responsible for one that would be in my top 10, which is A Room with a View. You went another way. You picked Howard's End. What resonated with you there?
Well, there's a kind of depth of characterization there and kind of a deeper emotion. I mean, Room with a View is a lot of fun. I enjoyed that as well. But this one seems, you know, I hate to use as big a word as profound, but it does seem like more profound story, a story really about what's important in life and how little we can know about ourselves and other people sometimes and what really matters. And I found it, you know, every time I see it, just exceptionally moving.
And here's a clip.
I didn't have to marry, but I did. My family wouldn't have anything to do with this. They tried to stop me, but I married her all the same. Because I promised. Mr. Baden, where would she be today after the Mr. Wilcoxes of this world had finished with it?
It would never, never, not in a thousand years, enter that man's mind that he'd done anything wrong. Because there's nothing here, and nothing here. And you're the opposite. You believe in personal responsibility. And personal everything.
Very nice. What good am I to myself or to Jackie? Marrying her only to pull her down with me so we can starve together.
You'll find another position somewhere, surely you will.
You don't know what you're talking about. If rich people fail at one profession, they can try another. But with us, once a man over 20 loses his own particular job, he's done for.
And that was Helena Bonham Carter, by the way. The Merchant Ivory team loved her. Did she show up anywhere else on your list?
I don't think so. You know, a lot of the films she's been in lately are, you know, kind of darker and weirder and not the kind of thing I'm naturally attracted to.
Let's go to the phones then. We've got Earl on the line from Medford. Hi, Earl.
Hi. I have a nomination. 2001, A Space Odyssey. I think it really broke through many obstacles and technical obstacles to really upgrade that genre a lot.
That's a great one, Earl. 2001, Space Odyssey. Is that one that was ever a contender for you, Kenneth?
Well, I admire it a lot. It's just, you know, Kubrick could be, at least for my taste, a little bit of a cold filmmaker. And it just, you know, I just didn't connect with them to that extent. But it's a remarkable piece of filmmaking, for sure.
It's interesting to me to hear you say you thought he was a cold filmmaker. What does that mean?
I don't feel that he feels distant from his characters. I don't feel any kind of empathy. I feel like he's interested in the look, you know, in the technical aspects of filmmaking. He's not really interested in character and emotion. he has to deal with it, but I don't think that's where his interest lies.
That's an interesting thing, and I'm going to bring this up just because you write about George R. R. Martin in your introduction, who famously kills off, you know, legions of characters per book. Do you find the same critique there, or does he care about his characters?
You know, I don't have time to watch Game of Thrones. I'm probably the only person in America.
Well, you're kind of busy.
And I hear it's great. You know, it's not because I don't think I'd enjoy it. I mean, what I do looking at film is very consuming of my time. I just don't have time for other things.
Gotcha. All right, we're going to go on now. Thank you for that call. John is next in Washburn. Hi, John.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I have a handful of movies that I've watched repeatedly that I absolutely love, but my number one movie is Creator with Peter O'Toole and Virginia Madsen, Mario Hemingway, and Vincent Spano. I have literally watched that movie hundreds of times.
Wow.
I can never get tired of it. It's got everything, comedy, heartbreak. It's great.
Wonderful. A movie called The Creator. Have you seen that one, Kenneth?
I it's been quite a while since I saw it. I mean, anything with Peter O'Toole. Peter O'Toole was a marvelous screen actor, and anything with him is worth watching. But this one is just it's a distant memory for me. I did see it when it came out, but it's been a while.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. We're going to go next to Ellen in Brookfield. Hi there, Ellen.
Hi. Well, this movie is, you know, certainly not in the classics category, but I think the most perfect movie I've ever seen is The Princess Bride, and I will see it time and time and time again. I think everything came together in that to just create a perfect film of the subtle comedy, commenting on swashbuckler classic movies. All the performances were fabulous, and there are just such funny lines that are so repeatable from that movie, and it's just a totally endearing movie to me.
I agree. It seems to just hit its pitch perfectly, and it is one that I think holds up to repeat viewing. It's fun for me to watch, at least. It actually kind of reminds me, Kenneth, of what you say about Singing in the Rain. In fact, you start your essay about Singing in the Rain talking about how the president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences wanted to give himself hope on September 11th, 2001, and he picked Singing in the Rain. Now, these are sort of lighter movies, but they still have something that's really pleasing to the heart somehow.
Absolutely. No, I think this is, you know, I just saw, not 2001, I just saw Singing in the Rain recently, and it's absolutely delightful still. I mean, the numbers with Donald O'Connor singing make him laugh. It feels like you're watching a special effect when you're watching a human being because the dancing and contortions he does are so amazing. These films kind of make you feel life is worth living, you know. Maybe it is.
Singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feel, and I'm happy again.
A little bit of Singing in the Rain there. That's one I don't think I've ever watched all the way through, but it's, you know the iconic song, you know the iconic scene, and it does kind of make you feel good. It's got that heart.
You should watch it all the way through. You'll have a good time.
I should. You're right. It's going to be on my list. What do you love most about that movie in particular?
I just love the high spirits of it. It's infectious high spirits. You know, sometimes high spirits kind of can put you off and you say, well, those people are having a good time, but it's not for me. This is really a movie where you feel like you're sharing in the fun with the characters, and that's a wonderful feeling.
And speaking of spirits, Spirited Away also shows up on your list. This is from the Japanese director Miyazaki. This film blew you away the first time you saw it. Let's hear a clip.
You shouldn't be here. Get out of here now!
What?
It's almost night. Leave before it gets dark. They're lighting the lamps. Get out of here. You've got to get across the river. Go. I'll distract them.
Clip there from Spirited Away by Miyazaki. And I shared a common experience, I think, with you when you saw it. I saw that and I thought, what was that? Like, it didn't fall into any particular sort of, you know, regular code of story. It sort of made up its own rules as it went along, and it was just so fanciful and imaginative.
Yeah, it's really like nothing, you know, anyone has ever seen before. He's got his own style. Whatever you think you know and you've seen in animation, if you haven't seen Miyazaki, you just haven't seen anything like this. And he creates a magical world, a world of his own that he, again, he allows us to enter with him. And we're just kind of, you know, it's called spirited away, but we're really swept away. They might as well call it swept away.
Yeah, and he just went on and got bigger after that, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, he was always a major figure in Japan. But one of the things that happened is that one of the people, you know, who's a big fan of his work is John Lasseter, who runs Pixar and runs Disney. And he saw to it that Miyazaki's films came out on a regular basis in this country and elsewhere in the world. And, you know, they're marvelous films. And when people saw them, they embraced them.
All right. Well, next time you run into John Lasseter, say thank you. I love his movies. Okay, let's go to Leah in Green Bay. Hi there, Leah.
Hi. I'm going to say three really fast. One was All of Me with Steve Martin and Lily Tomlin. Steve Martin was amazing in his physical comedy in that one, and it was a really great movie. And also Wallace and Gromit.
Mm.
I love them. And also My Favorite Year with Peter O'Toole.
Great. Thank you so much for those. And it's not really something you talk about explicitly on your list, Kenneth, but do you have a favorite comic actor? Are you allowed to say you have one you favor?
You know, I want to say this question. It's not on there in that specifically, but in some ways, I mean, instinctively, what I say when I hear that is I say Buster Keaton, because even though he was a silent actor and we can't run a clip, but we can all visualize his kind of great stone face, the way he never expressed emotion. But he was just extraordinarily adept physically. There was nothing he couldn't do, no antic he couldn't master. And to watch his films at the height of his career, the invention and the humor is just unparalleled.
And Kenneth, I want to ask you, I mean, it sounds as though movies are full immersion experiences for you. You really like to get into the heart of them. If you could join the cast of a movie and disappear into it forever as your version of heaven, as your version of the afterlife, what would it be?
Oh, gosh, that's, you know, and in fact, there is a film called Afterlife, a wonderful Japanese film, which deals with a similar situation. You know, that's a wonderful question. I'm afraid to answer it because I don't want to leave them all out. I don't want to think, oh, my God, I should have said this. You know, but I'm going to think about that one. That's a wonderful thought.
All right. Well, let me know when you think of something. Kenneth, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. This has been a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Kenneth Turan, the film critic for the Los Angeles Times and NPR's Morning Edition. He's the author of the new book. It's called Not to Be Missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. And you can volunteer your votes for your not-to-be-missed movies from your lifetime. I'd be curious to know what you're thinking. You can leave them on the Central Time Facebook page.
You know, I said Maltese Falcon, Veronica. Did you, while prepping this, did you think of one for you?
I thought of A Room with a View, and one I think I could watch forever and ever is Lord of the Rings, the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
I'm in the midst of rewatching that myself.
Yep.